this is a critical issue with regards to the shamanic transformation, is that people go through these terrible, terrible experiences, often drug-induced, by the way, with regards to the shaman. They usually use psychedelic chemicals of one form or another, often mushrooms, but they've come up with some very strange concoctions like ayahuasca down in the Amazon. And ayahuasca is an amazing substance. It's made out of the bark of one thing and another plant whose name I don't remember, that hardly even grow in the same place and that have to be cooked together in a special way. And no one has any idea how the damn Amazonians figured that out. It looks impossible. And if you ask them, they say, well, the plants told us how to do it, which, you know, Western people don't find very helpful. But the shamans are perfectly happy with that description. And ayahuasca takes them apart. And it does that in part because it affects the serotonergic system very, very powerfully, like all psychedelics do. And it transports them to another world. And that's how they interpret it. And what we know about psychedelics, you could put in a thimble and then throw the thimble away. We know nothing about psychedelics. There's new experiments going on at Johns Hopkins, for example, with psilocybin, which is part of this active chemical in magic mushrooms. Same structure, basically, as LSD and mescaline. And all the real psychedelics have basically the same structure, except the one that's derived from Amanita muscaria, which is called muscarinic acid. And it's its own weird thing that no one knows anything about. Anyways, they have profound neurochemical effects in very small doses. And the research group at Johns Hopkins has given psilocybin to research subjects, you know, purified psilocybin, because they started the new experimentation with psychedelics, and that's been banned for like 40 years, because psychedelics were so terrifying to our culture that we just put them away. It's like, whoa, no, we're not going there. And so even from a research perspective, and even though some of the psychedelics look very promising for the treatment of disorders like alcoholism, they recently used psilocybin to help people stop smoking down at Johns Hopkins. And I think they had an 80% success rate, which is just, like, that's just absolutely mind-boggling. And so, but if you give people psilocybin and they have a mystical experience, which is very common among people who take these sorts of chemicals, then their personality transforms permanently, such that 1 year later, they're one standard deviation higher in openness. And openness is the creativity dimension. And that seems to be a permanent transformation. And so that's really remarkable. And about 80% of the people who undergo the Johns Hopkins experiments report that the experience is like one of the two or three most important things they've ever, that's ever happened to them. And so, well, that's something, you know, it's like, and then there's this guy named Rick Strassman down at, I think he was at the University of Texas, and he did experimentation with DMT. And DMT, dimethyltryptamine, if I remember correctly, is the active ingredient in ayahuasca. And you produce it in your brain. And it's in plants. It's like a very common chemical. But DMT is a weird hallucinogen because it has an extraordinarily short mechanism of action. It's like, and people who take it report that they're blasted out of their body, like out of a cannon, and then they go out somewhere and encounter beings of various sorts, and then 10 minutes later, they're back. And virtually everyone reports that, which is really strange. And so Strassman was giving people DMT intravenously so that the trip would last longer. This was all you know, NIH-funded experimentation, all cleared with the relevant ethics boards, all conducted within the last 10 years. And he basically quit doing it because he was a pretty straight scientist. You know, he was measuring heart rate and pulse and all that sort of thing, trying to look at the physiology. And then the people he was giving these chemicals to kept coming back and telling him these crazy stories. And, it was too much for him, you know, and no wonder, you know, because they all said the same thing. And he'd say, well, that was a dream. And they'd say, no, and it was the most real thing that ever happened to me. And he'd say, well, you know, it's an archetypal experience. And they'd say, no, that was no archetypal experience. I went somewhere else and I saw things and I'm back and, like, I don't care what you think. And, like, who the hell knows, right? Because it's all subjective. But the weird thing about it is that everyone's reporting the same thing. How the hell do you account for that? And then the shaman, you know, when they take these psychedelic chemicals, they basically say the same thing. They say, well, first of all, it more or less killed me. That's this. You know, I dissolved to a skeleton, and then I climbed the tree that unites heaven and earth, and I went into the realm of the gods, and they gave me some information, and I'm back. It's like, okay, well, you know, we don't really know what to make of that. And certainly that's what Eliade describes when he describes the shamanic procession, not the shamanic initiation. And You know, there's dissolution to a skeleton first, and then like a death, a symbolic death, or experienced as an actual death, and then bang, up into the realm of the gods, and then they come back. It's a very old idea, and that's a medieval representation of the tunnel that people travel through at the end of their life to, you know, to find the light, which is a very common near-death experience report, and people don't have any idea what the hell to do with those reports, except say, well, it's the paroxysms of the dying brain, which you'd expect to be a hell of a lot more random, in my opinion. And the idea is there's a rebirth after that. And you know, here, this is the Scandinavian representation of that tree that unites earth with heaven. And so there's the Scandinavian representation. It has a snake, snakes down here eating it. And then that's the Amazonian representation. It's like, how the hell do you account for that? I mean, those pictures are so similar that it's just, it's beyond belief. Well, you know, we lived in trees for a long time. A long, 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 long time. Millions of years. And there were lots of snakes around them. And so the idea that reality is a tree that's surrounded by a snake is, that's in us, man. It's down there. It's deep. And there's something about it that's true. Now, not true like we normally think of truth, but truth, true in an entirely different manner. So, and all that's pretty damn strange. We'll stop with this. My son drew this when he was 7 years old. It blew me away, man. I thought it was so cool, so I had it laminated. And so here is what it is. On the right-hand side, that's order. It's like the yin-yang thing. That's order. Left side, chaos, right? And those are all mushroom houses, which I thought was amazing. And then there's this river that runs right down the middle, like the line for order and chaos. And then there's this tree that goes up to heaven, and that's heaven up there. It's like, there's St. Peter, there's the pearly gates, there's the clouds. It's like, he never went to church, you know? It's like, what the hell? And then there's a little bug there that goes up and down from heaven to earth. And that was him. And I thought, he had a very organized psyche, that kid. He was a very, very stable kid and still is. And he drew that and I thought, Jesus, that's just bloody well unbelievable. And I still think that when I look at it. And that's a great example of an archetype. Fundamentalists and atheistic scientists have the same problem. The fundamentalists, so we could say the Christian fundamentalists in the US, make the proposition that biblical stories, we'll call them mythological stories, are literal representations of the truth. But, and that might be true depending on what you mean by literal. But what they mean by literal, or what they attempt to make literal mean, is that they're in the same category as scientific facts. Because they don't have the idea that there are different ways of approaching truth, and that truths can serve different purposes. They don't have a sense that your definition of truth is actually something like a tool rather than an ontological statement about the reality of the world. And so the fundamentalists basically make the proposition that the idea that God created the world in 6 days, 5,000 years ago, is literally true. And they get the 5,000 year estimate, by the way, by going through the genealogies in the Old Testament and adding up the hypothetical ages and figuring out, you know, how long before Moses, Adam lived. And some bishop did that back in the, I think it was in the mid-1800s. I might be wrong about that, but it was somewhere back about that time. And more or less, that's been accepted as canonical fact ever since. And then the scientists say, well, yeah, those are empirical truths. They're just wrong. See, and that's the only difference there is between the fundamentalists and the atheist scientists. The fundamentalists say, those are fundamental scientific truths, and they're right. And the scientists say, well, they're scientific truths, they just happen to be wrong. Well, I think that's a stupid argument, personally. I mean, for a bunch of reasons. One is that the people who wrote the ancient stories that we have access to were in no way, shape, or form scientists. You know, modern people tend to think that you think like a scientist, and people have always thought that way. First of all, you do not think like a scientist. Even scientists hardly even think like scientists. But if you're not scientifically trained, you don't think like a scientist at all. So one of the things, for example, that characterizes your thinking is confirmation bias. And so if you have a theory, what you do is wander around in the world looking for reasons why it's true. And a scientist does exactly the opposite of that in the little tiny narrow domain where he or she is actually capable of being a scientist. And what they have is a theory and look for a way to prove it wrong. But believe me, you don't run around doing that. I mean, you can train yourself, so now and then you can do that. You know, you can learn to listen to people, for example, on the off chance that you might be wrong. But that is by no means a natural way of thinking. And of course, the fundamental philosophical axioms of the scientific method weren't developed until Descartes and Bacon and who else? Descartes, Bacon. There's one more. Anyways, the name escapes me at the moment. But you can argue about when science emerged, but it certainly emerged in its articulated form within the last 1,000 years. I think you could say even more specifically that it emerged in the last 500 years. Now, you might argue with that and say, well, what about the Greeks and other people who were fairly technologically sophisticated or who invented geometry or that kind of thing? But yeah, bare precursors to the idea of empirical observation. Aristotle, for example, when he was writing down his knowledge of the world, it never occurred to him to actually go out in the world and look at it to see if what he assumed about it was true. And it certainly never occurred to Aristotle to get 20 people to go look at the same thing independently, write down exactly how they went about doing it, compare the records, and then extract out what was common. I mean, that seems self-evident to us to some degree, but, you know, it was by no means self-evident to anyone 500 years ago, and people still don't do it. So, it's not plausible. If you know anything about the history of ideas, it's not plausible to posit that stories about the nature of reality that existed before 500 years ago were scientific in any but the most cursory of ways. So why we have that argument continually is somewhat beyond me. Part of the reason is, though, that everyone, fundamentalists included, really believe in scientific facts, even though they hate it. They'll use computers, they'll fly. Computers wouldn't work unless quantum mechanics were correct. The fact that you use a high-tech device indicates through your action that you actually accept the theories upon which it's predicated, right? The same as flying, same as anything you do in a complex technological society. You're stuck with it. You're reading by the lights. Do they work? Yeah, they work. Well, so it's really hard for people who are trying to hold on to a way of looking at the world that appears to contradict the scientific claims when everything they do is predicated on their acceptance of the validity of the scientific claims. It's really problematic for people, and it's problematic in a real way, I think, because one of the problems with the scientific viewpoint is it doesn't tell you anything about what you should do with your life. It doesn't solve the problem of value at all. In fact, it might make it more difficult, because one of the fundamental scientific claims, roughly speaking, is that every fact is of equal utility. At least from a scientific perspective, right? There's no hierarchy of facts. It's not exactly true, because you can think of one theory as more true than another, but that boils down to saying that it's more useful than another. So I don't think that that's a really good exception. Okay, so fine. You got the scientific atheists on one end, and you got the religious fundamentalists on the other, and what they both agree on, whether they like it or not, is that there's so much power in the scientific method that it's difficult to dispute the validity of scientific facts. And they seem to exist in contradiction to the older archaic stories if you also accept them as fact-based accounts. So what do we do about that? Well, if you're on the scientific atheist end of things, you say, well, those old stories are just superstitious science, second-rate, barbaric, archaic forms of science. You just dispense with them. They're nothing but trouble. And if you're on the fundamentalist side, you say, well, we'll try to shoehorn science into this framework, and really that doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well with the claims of evolution, for example. In fact, it works very badly. And that's a problem, because evolutionary theory is like, it's a killer theory. And it's really, really hard. And like, it's not a complete theory, and there's lots of things we don't know about evolution, but, you know, trying to hand wave that away, that's not going to work without dispensing with most of biology. So that's a big problem. So here's another way of thinking about it. You don't just need one way of looking at the world. Maybe you need two ways of looking at the world, and I'm not exactly sure how they should be related to one another, like which should take precedence under which circumstance. But one problem is, what's the world made of? you know, what's the world conceptualized as an objective place made of? And the other is, how should you conduct yourself while you're alive? And there's no reason to assume that those questions can be answered using the same approach. I mean, physics has its methods, and chemistry has its methods, and biology has its methods. So a method for obtaining the truth can be bound to a domain. So why would we necessarily assume that you could use the same set of tools to represent the world as a place of objects and to represent it as a place in which a biological creature would act? I mean, anyways, I'm suggesting that we don't view it that way, that we have two different viewpoints. Maybe they can be brought together, although it's not obvious how, but that it's not a tenable solution to get rid of one in favor of the other. And I think the reason for that is that you need to know how to conduct yourself in the world. You have to have a value system. You can't even look at the damn world without a value system. It's not possible. Your emotional health is dependent on a value system. The way you interact with other people is dependent on a value system. There's no getting away from it. And you say, well, there's no justification for any value system from a scientific perspective. You're going to draw that conclusion that no value system is valid. Where the hell does that leave you? There's no down. There's no up. There's no rationale for moving in any direction. There's not even really any rationale for living. And so people say things like that. Well, why the hell should I care what happens in a million years? Who's going to know the difference? It's like, yeah, yeah. True. Stupid, but true. And the reason I think it's stupid is because it's just a game, you know. I can take anything of any sort and find a context in which it's irrelevant. It's just a rational game. It's like, who cares if 100 children freeze to death in a blizzard? What difference is it going to make a billion years? Well, what do you say to someone who says that? You say, well, seems like the wrong frame of reference, bucko. That's what it looks like to me, you know. Because at some point you question the damn frame of reference, not what you derive from it. And it certainly seems to me that situations like that don't allow you to use that kind of frame of reference. There's something inhumane about it. And that trumps the logic, or at least it should. And if it doesn't, then all hell breaks loose, and that doesn't seem to be a good thing. So I used to live in Montreal. I lived in a poor neighborhood. And one day I was out in the back alley building a fence, because I was putting a little fence around my little tiny backyard. And there was a house across the alley, down the street a ways, where there was a lot of, like, not good partying. A lot of bikers were hanging around there. And I knew there was a little kid that lived there as well. Anyways, I was out there in the back alley pounding away on my fence, and these little kids came up, and they were little. They were like 3 and 4 years old, hey? And they spoke Joual, right, kind of really heavily accented Quebecois French. And so my French isn't good, so I could hardly understand them. But they were watching me hammer, and they got a little closer. And they had one kid who was clearly the leader, had a real scowl on his face, hey? And so they were watching, and I kind of motioned to one of them that they could use the hammer. And that kid said, I'm going to mangle this, but he said, je volais, or something like that. And what it meant is, I'll steal that. And so I thought, you know, and then he came over and he tugged on it, and he wanted me to take it. And he was quite angry, and, well, I wasn't going to let him take it. And then so I couldn't engage him. I couldn't get him to play, you know, and his buddies were sort of hanging around behind him, and they wouldn't come and play because he wouldn't. And so he was hostile right away to me. And then, so the fence piece was laying out in the alley, and these little monsters started running across it, which I thought was really remarkable, you know. But it was terrible at the same time, because they were really little kids. That shouldn't be happening when you're like 3 or 4. If that's happening at that age, things are not good. And so that kid was already, like, seriously not happy with the world. And, you know, I'd been studying antisocial behavior for a long time by that point, and I knew that the kids who are destined to jail later in their lives are kids who are rough and tough when they're 2 years old, but then don't get socialized, or maybe worse, they get anti-socialized, which is exactly what happened to this kid. He'd obviously been ignored and abused. Certainly no one had ever played with him in any real way, because he wouldn't play. And it's not good if a kid is that little and you can't get them to play. Something's gone seriously wrong. Because they're so playful at that age that, like, it's like 90% of them. Anyway, so they were running back and forth on this fence. I thought, stomping on it, you know? And I was right there. I thought, well, first of all, I thought that was remarkable. But I also thought it was absolutely horrifying because, you know, in some sense, I could see where this kid was headed and why at that early stage in his life. It's really, it's not a pleasant thing to behold, you know? But there was nothing that could be done about it. And that's kind of what this Lampwick is like. He's prematurely cynical. This kid was already cynical and he was like 4 years old. You know, most kids don't get cynical till they're teenagers. You know, and then often they don't get completely cynical and usually they more or less grow out of it. But it had happened to him much earlier. So this Lampwick character, he's already decided that he knows everything, that everyone else's opinion is worth nothing, and that there's nothing in culture or society that holds any utility whatsoever for someone like him. Now, you can imagine developing that way if you were raised in a family where people were generally lying to you and that they randomly treated you or neglected you and that you couldn't discern anything about them that was admirable or positive. You know, it's, of course you'd assume that the whole structure is corrupt and that you had to take care of yourself and no one else. Well, not of course. Not everyone assumes that under those situations. I shouldn't say of course. But it's a logical set of conclusions. So, and of course, it's proportionate to some degree to how much abuse you take. Although there are lots of stories of people who've been terribly abused as children who grew up to be, you know, kind, remarkable, responsible, thoughtful people who were absolutely opposed to abuse instead of propagating it. There's no direct causal pathway. Anyways, Lampwick is pretty happy to be on this coach way to Pleasure Island, which he's heard about. He said, well, it's all you can eat, it's all you can smoke, you don't have to do any work, and you can do anything you want. So you might say, well, it's too good to be true. Like the gingerbread house in the Hansel and Gretel story, right? The kids are lost, there's a gingerbread house. It's a house, which is something they need, and it's made out of cookies. It looks like it's a little bit too good to be true. And of course, in the house, there's the negative part of that, which is the old witch who wants to eat children. And that's a story about what happens to people if they're offered more than they should be offered. So, anyways, Lampwick is firing off, he has a little slingshot, and he's firing off pebbles at the horses who are pulling the carriage, and that's just kind of the guy that he is. So he takes Pinocchio under his wing, and the cricket is down there in the dust. He's caught back up to the carriage, but he's having a rough time at this point. And this is also a story to some degree about the transition into adolescence, you know, because adolescence is a time people are still pretty impulsive and their view is quite short-term and they're more likely to pursue immediate pleasures and all of that, and that can get really out of hand. So anyways, they separate from the mainland and go on a boat. And so they're off to Pleasure Island, dark place. And the coachman opens the gates and lets the delinquents into Pleasure Island, and they basically have a riot. And this is Pleasure Island here. It's full of amusement park rides. And you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about horror movies, I'm sure you've noticed this, is that they're often set in amusement parks, and clowns are often characters of horror. We'll leave the clowns aside for now, but the amusement park thing, that's pretty interesting. It's like, why in the world would an amusement park be a place of horror? And the first question might be, well, have you ever been to an amusement park? Because there is something about them that's really, they have a dark side, a clear dark side. And part of it is that people with nothing better to do are spending money stupidly, and they're being fleeced by the people who operate the amusement park. You know, and they have, let's say, a stereotypically dark reputation, and they're moving around all the time, which is also something that psychopaths do, and all they're doing is moving from community to community and taking the money from the rubes, fundamentally. And so, the amusement park, well, if you walk through an amusement park with that sort of thing in mind, maybe that's also coloring your vision, of course, but it's something that you can see very immediately. So there's something about them that's sort of deeply sad, but there's also that there's an underlying horror that characterizes them, that it's easy for horror movie or horror novel writers to immediately expand upon, and there's something about it that makes sense to people. So it's too easy, maybe that's, and it's also all short-term gratification, that's the other thing. So you spend your money very rapidly and it's gone. Yep.
Well, it seems like a sort of a celebration of meanings divorced back from reality.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's the impulsive element. The comment was it's a celebration of meanings divorced from reality. Yeah, that's, well, it's also outside of reality, right? That's why it's on an island. It's a separate universe. And it's a universe where nothing that's happening is connected to anything outside. And you're spending your hard-earned money, let's say, but it isn't that much, it's certainly not an investment. It's not that much different than burning it. Well, it is, because of course you get some pleasure out of it, but it isn't. Going there every day is probably not the wisest move that you could make. So the animators do a good job of presenting the, what would you call it, the enforced hedonism, I guess I would say, of a place like that. This is a place where you're going to have fun. That's what it's for. So, anyways, Lampwick, who's got this very arrogant look on his face and this kind of strut, it's a bravado, that's what that's called. It's a false confidence, and it's the sort of thing that people do when they're trying to impress upon others that they're high in the dominance hierarchy, but really they're not. So it's a mimicry of dominance, but it's something that can be intimidating, there's no doubt about it. I had a friend, he didn't come to a good end, this person. He was a real good friend of mine when I was in junior high and high school, and he was kind of crazy. And he was tall, he was about 6'7", and he was pretty thin. And we used to go out to the bar now and then, and in many of the bars that we lived in this little town, there were bullies, and these were guys, and I worked in the bars, and I used to watch these guys, and they'd basically, there was a handful of them in town, pretty psychopathic types, and they'd go to the bar, and all they'd do is sit there and wait for someone to come in who they could beat up, and they knew who it was as soon as they walked in. That's actually why they were at the bar, and so they'd wait till someone came in who didn't look very confident, and who could likely be intimidated by this sort of thing, and then they'd tell them to come outside for a fight, and if they didn't, well, then they'd, of course, make fun of them, and if they did, well, generally, they'd beat them up. My friend kind of caught on to this trick, and he started going to bars, and every time that someone like that came near him, he'd go outside and fight with them, and one of the things he observed right away is that almost inevitably, when he went outside with them, they'd shake hands and make friends. So as soon as he, and it was really remarkable watching him, because he wasn't a particularly physically powerful person, although he was extraordinarily tall. But he had started to play this game, and he did it for a long time. And I don't remember him ever actually having to fight. He just stared them down, fundamentally. So it was a very interesting thing to watch. But it was an indication to me of exactly how shallow this kind of bravado bullying actually is.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.